What if the next great leap in warfare, the next true game changer, isn't a faster jet or a stealthier submarine? What if it's something that just hangs there silently at the very edge of space, watching everything?
It's a chilling thought, but it's not science fiction anymore. We're talking about a technology that blurs the line between aircraft and satellite, creating a persistent, unblinking eye over any point on Earth.
Exactly. And for me, this whole topic is, well, it's personal in a way. I grew up completely obsessed with the stories of the Cold War, the U-2 spy plane, the State Route 71 Blackbird. These incredible, almost mythical machines flying at the edge of the atmosphere, they were the original sentinels of the skies.
Right, the pinnacle of manned reconnaissance.
And now we're talking about their descendants. But these are unmanned. They can stay up for months, even years. It feels like we're living in the future I used to write about.
Yeah, and for me, the fascination comes from a slightly different angle. I remember the immense excitement around projects like Google's Project Loon, using high-altitude balloons to bring internet to remote areas.
No.
It was this utopian vision of technology connecting the world.
Oh, I remember that. A fleet of balloons.
And to see that same fundamental concept, a long endurance platform in the stratosphere, now being adapted and perfected for surveillance, for communications, for the theater of war.
Yeah.
It's a profound shift. It raises so many questions.
It really does. Today we're ascending to that very stratosphere to talk about these machines. They're called high-altitude pseudo-satellites, or IAPS. The sentinel of the skies is being unmasked.
And that name, pseudo-satellite, is so perfectly descriptive. They operate in that gray area, that sweet spot in the atmosphere above commercial air traffic, above the weather, but well below orbital satellites.
Giving them the persistence of a satellite without the immense cost and launch logistics. It's a revolution hiding in plain sight. So today we'll explore what this all means. We'll get into the incredible technological hurdles, solar power, lightweight materials, autonomy.
And of course, the massive implications for modern warfare and international security. When you can watch a location not for hours, but for months, it changes everything.
And that's the word right there, isn't it? Months. It completely upends military doctrine. Think about it. For decades, the Holy Grail was reducing the sensor-to-shooter timeline. You see something with a satellite, you scramble the jet. That takes time. But what if the sensor and the shooter, or at least the communications relay for the shooter, are the same platform and it never leaves?
It shrinks the battlefield, or rather, it makes the battlefield transparent for the side that controls that stratosphere. There's no longer a place to hide. The traditional cat and mouse game of moving assets between satellite passes, that's over. The eye isn't blinking anymore.
So the advantage is persistence. But that persistence must come at an incredible technological cost. These things aren't nuclear powered. How do you keep a vehicle in the air for months at a time, 70,000 feet up?
You basically have to wage a constant war against gravity and the setting of the sun. It's all about energy. Specifically, solar power. During the day, the wings, which are covered in hyper-efficient solar cells, have to collect enough energy to power the flight systems, the sensors, the communication arrays, and charge the batteries.
To survive the night.
To survive the night. And that is the single greatest design challenge. Every ounce matters. The batteries have to be incredibly energy dense, but also lightweight. The airframe itself has to be, usually, just impossibly light. We're talking carbon fiber composites that make a Formula One car look like a tank.
So you end up with these almost ethereal looking aircraft. I've seen the pictures of things like the Airbus Zephyr. It has the wingspan of a 737, but weighs less than a small car.
Exactly. It's more of a flying solar panel than a traditional aircraft. The design isn't for speed or maneuverability. The entire design is slave to the energy equation. Can it gather enough sunlight to endure the darkness?
That's fascinating. So its primary defense isn't speed or stealth in the traditional sense, but its altitude. It just floats above everything else.
That's a huge part of it. It operates in a layer of the atmosphere. Pilots sometimes call the death zone. Too high for most jets, way too low for satellites. It's an empty frontier. It's above the weather, above commercial traffic, so it can just loiter, unbothered.
But surely it's not invisible. It can be tracked. What's to stop an adversary from developing a long-range surface-to-air missile to just swat it out of the sky?
Oh, that's the next chapter in this chess game for sure. It's a real threat. But hitting a slow-moving, incredibly fragile, low-signature object at 70,000 feet is a non-trivial problem.
It's not like shooting down a fighter jet. And you raise a good point. This drives the next evolution. Do you make them stealthier, give them defensive countermeasures? Or do you just make them so cheap and numerous that losing one doesn't matter? The swarm concept, but in the stratosphere.
That last idea, the swarm, that's a fundamentally different philosophy, isn't it? It's not about building an invulnerable castle in the sky, like a State Route 71. It's about creating a cloud of disposable eyes. The loss of one is just statistically irrelevant.
It's a numbers game. And it's a shift from exquisite, high-cost platforms to what you might call good enough platforms at scale. The cost-benefit analysis completely flips. Why spend $1 billion on one platform that is a catastrophic loss if shot down, when you can have 1,000 cheaper ones for the same price?
But does that work for this kind of asset? I mean, we're talking about something that needs to stay aloft for months. That implies a certain level of quality, of reliability. Can you mass produce that kind of endurance?
Well, that's the bleeding edge of the problem. It's about revolutionizing the manufacturing process. You're not hand-building these things in a clean room like a satellite. You're aiming for an automated production line. Think more like car manufacturing than traditional aerospace.
So the individual unit might be less reliable, but the network itself, the swarm, is incredibly resilient because of redundancy. If one fails, another one just drifts over and takes its place?
Precisely. The system becomes fault-tolerant. One platform's solar panel degrades, or its battery fails to hold a full charge. In a single asset mission, that's a failure. In a swarm, the network just routes around the damage. It retasks a healthier asset. The mission continues without a hiccup.
I find that unsettling in a way. It removes the human element of risk and heroism that I grew up with, the pilot in the cockpit. Instead, you have this cold, autonomous logic of the collective.
But isn't that the whole trajectory of military tech, removing the human from direct harm's way? And I think you're touching on a deeper point, command and control. How do you even manage a swarm of 100 of these things?
Yeah, you can't have 100 pilots sitting in 100 different trailers in Nevada. That defeats the whole purpose.
You can't. So you need an AI, or at the very least, a very, very sophisticated autonomous mission commander. A system that doesn't just fly the platforms, but manages the entire constellation. It decides which platform has the best look angle, which one needs to conserve power, which one to sacrifice to get a better view of a pop-up threat.
Mm-hmm. So the human operator, their role changes completely. They're not a pilot anymore. They're a system administrator? A grand strategist telling the AI, I need persistent coverage of this grid square, and the machine just makes it happen.
They become the conductor of the orchestra, not the first violinist. They set the intent, and the autonomous system handles the incredibly complex minute-by-minute execution. It's the only way to manage that level of complexity in real time.
Okay, but let's play devil's advocate for the castle approach. Isn't there an advantage to having one platform that is just so advanced, so capable, that it can do the job of 50 cheaper ones? Better sensors, better communications, maybe even its own defensive systems.
There absolutely is, and that's the debate happening in defense circles right now. The argument for the high-end castle is that it can carry a payload a swarm can't. Think of a massive radar array or a powerful signals intelligence package that requires a lot of power and physical space. You can't distribute that across 100 little platforms.
Right. So for certain missions, you still need that single exquisite asset. You need the queen on the chessboard, not just a board full of pawns.
Exactly. It's likely the future isn't one or the other, but a mix. You'll have the high-value, exquisite platforms doing the heavy lifting, protected and supported by swarms of smaller, more disposable assets that act as decoys, communication relays, and forward sensors.
A tiered approach. That makes sense. It's like a complete ecosystem you're building in the stratosphere. And it strikes me that we spent this whole time talking about this as a state-on-state, military-level technology. But the barrier to entry for this feels like it's dropping fast.
Oh, it's plummeting. I mean, we're not quite at the build one in your garage stage, but the core technologies, lightweight composites, solar cells, autonomous flight controllers, they're all becoming more accessible. What happens when a non-state actor or even a mega corporation decides they want their own persistent eye in the sky?
That's the question that's been nagging at me. It completely bypasses traditional notions of airspace. I mean, where does a country's sovereignty end? Does it go all the way to space?
There's no fence up there.
There isn't. And international law is murky at best on this. It's that gray zone, again, not just in altitude, but in legality. It's not an orbiting satellite, which is governed by space treaties. But it's not a traditional aircraft either. It's something new.
And that's what I find so profoundly unsettling as we wrap this up. The technology is incredible, a genuine marvel. But we've essentially created a new ungoverned high ground.
And history teaches us that whenever humanity finds a new high ground, we fight over it.
I see that. I really do. But I also see, and maybe this is my inner tech optimist speaking, I see the other side of the coin. The same platform that can track a tank column for months could also track the melting of a polar ice cap with unprecedented detail.
So for climate science, disaster relief.
For bringing internet to a village cut off by a flood. For precision agriculture to prevent a famine. The persistence we've been discussing as a military advantage is also a monumental advantage for science and humanitarian aid. The tool itself is neutral. It's about who wields it and why.
I suppose that's the duality of every great technological leap, isn't it? From the first bronze sword to the splitting of the atom. It's never simple. For me, the lasting image is still that of the Silent Sentinel. We started this conversation talking about the U-2 and the Blackbird machines with pilots, with a human element of risk and return. Now the Sentinel is autonomous, it's collective, and it never sleeps. And I'm not entirely sure we're ready for that.
And I think my final thought is that we don't have a choice. It's here. The stratosphere is the new frontier, and the land rush has already begun. The challenge isn't stopping it, but figuring out how to live under this new, unblinking gaze. It's a conversation that's just getting started. What an incredible topic.
It really has, Mo. Thank you for thinking this through with me today.
Always a pleasure. And to everyone listening, thank you for joining us on this Ascent to the Edge of Space. We'll see you next time.